This podcast is brought to you by the Specialty Produce Network.
They say that spooning leads to forking, and they may be right. But Michael Gardner and Shane Fisher have a different take on the fine art of spooning and bring it to you weekly by delving into the corners, bright and dark, of today's food scene, from the business of food to the back of the house and what ends up on the plate.
All right, and we're back for part two of 7 days in the Valle de Guadalupe, all in, well, now one more half hour, featuring Drew Deckman and Scott Koenig.
Welcome back.
While we were between the segments, we actually got talking about something that was good enough that it really needs to be what we talk about right now, and that is it started with focus on the changes that the Valle de Guadalupe has experienced over the last decade, and I think that the one word answer to that is growth. Two words is massive growth,
exponential.
And I mean I've been going to the Valle. On and off for a while, but you know, really kind of intensely for about 4 years. And you know, the number of wineries has more than doubled in those 4 years. The number of restaurants has more than doubled in those 4 years. The quality of things, I mean, it's just been an unbelievable growth. And one of the big questions that a lot of people are finally starting to ask is, where does that end? And the answer to a lot of that seems to be one word: water.
Well, before we get into that, though, let's talk about the growth and the change in demographics first of all, because it's the growth is about people, right? It's not just about more wineries opening up, because if you don't have people there to enjoy the wineries or the food or the restaurant, then you don't really have the growth. You can open stuff all the time. But we were having a discussion. And by the way, I guess we're way off the script. Let's just throw this out the door now. We start, for you guys out there, we start with talking points, kind of what you could call it, a script. We generally get way off. We're about to just throw this thing out the door now. let's talk about the change in what you've seen people wanting, doing, seeing, eating, drinking in the last decade.
You know, when I first went down that trip in 2012, we were two folks from the U.S. going down with a van load of family from Mexico City. And what had happened is post-2011 with the wait at the border, and then getting into the early to mid-2000s with some of the cartel issues they were having in certain parts of Baja, is people from the U.S. had really not – they stopped going, essentially. I wouldn't say they completely stopped going, but it certainly slowed from, you know, quite a few people crossing the border to a trickle. So what had happened in the meantime when people from the U.S. stopped going is folks from all over Mexico began discovering the Valle. And started going in droves. It became a kind of a nice spot to take your family from Guadalajara or Monterrey or Mexico City and you know, spend a long weekend in the wine country for your country, because Baja California is the main, and the Valle de Guadalupe is the main wine producer for all of Mexico.
Over 90% of all wine produced in Mexico is produced indeed in the Valle de Guadalupe.
Yeah.
So, I think it's 95%.
Yeah, it's and you know, there's some other really nice growing areas, but there's nothing as intense as Northern Baja.
Right. But then you got food writers like Bill Esparza, who started going down there and reporting on the scene and the food, and that slowly started bringing people from the U.S. Down to see what was going on. And now, on any given week, when you go down there, you're going to see a good mixture of folks coming from north of the border. Mexican families from Baja California, and then Mexican families and folks who are coming from the mainland to enjoy the Valle de Guadalupe. So, you know, it was very much a Mexican audience back in 2012, and now it's shifted, and you see a lot of equilibrium in the folks going down there to enjoy the region, the food, and the wines.
Drew, what do you see as the guy that's been feeding them and pouring their wine?
You know, we opened in 2012. I've known the Valley pretty I guess sincerely or intensely since about 2010. When we first opened, there were a couple other notable restaurants that opened around the same time we did. There was maybe in the Valley, including all the little taco stands and everything, maybe 20 places where you could actually eat, that somebody's going to cook something for you. And this past season, we counted over 120.
Wow.
So that's in 5.5 years, just basically looking, I mean, that and that doesn't, it's not 120 fine dining restaurants. It's 120 places where you can stop and have a burrito,
right,
or you can have, you know, an 8-course meal at Laja, right, to run the whole spectrum.
And Laja was really the first restaurant that put the place
very,
on the
very,
map.
Very first. They were the innovators, you know, really inspiring project. I'm still inspired by it. Still my favorite restaurant in the valley.
It's a remarkable place. It was it was referred to by many as the Vida Guadalupe's French Laundry, yes. And you know, in a lot of ways, that's a very apt comparison.
You know, Jair was actually influenced by the culinary scene that was happening in Napa and Sonoma, yeah, at the time. So it was.
Is it Jair or Jair?
I always hear Jair. I could be wrong, Drew. You probably know the man.
Next question.
Yeah.
So you can let us know how it's pronounced. Jair.
It sounds like what you're both saying is that the Valle is really it caters to all economic levels. Is that true today, was it true back then and not true today?
I think it does. I think it's as the growth expands. I mean, there's obviously in a really high end market. It's still a fairly limited market. You know, sort of the comfort casual want to sort of be, can be when it wants to be fine dining, which I think is where we're in that segment.
Of course, right.
But I mean, there's people that live in Ensenada that they say they're going to the valley and they come to the first stoplight and they eat in a restaurant that's there. And that right. was their trip to the valley. They don't go to wineries. It's like, you know, going to the country for lunch kind of thing. Mm. And so there's a lot of that, restaurants where there's like brunches and stuff like that. And you know, the with the growth, and the same with the wineries, you could build a winery in 3 months. It takes 7 to 8 years to bring a vineyard online. So you look at the growth of the wineries. Okay. We've got a lot more wineries, but there's only like 15% new vineyard production or vineyards coming online. So there's a lot more wine being produced, but where's the fruit coming from?
Well, a lot of the fruit's coming from other valleys around, it's being brought in.
But it always has. Guadalupe Valley has most of the wineries, but most of the fruit comes from San Vicente,
right.
Santo Tomas, farther down, just because that's they're more ag sort of conducive. They've got water.
They have more water. They can grow it there better, but they make it in the Valle because it's an hour and a half from the border as opposed to 3 hours from the border.
And it makes more sense. There's more infrastructure. It's easy to get to, trucks in and out. Same thing with the restaurants. I mean, you can literally, you know, with a couple $1,000, you go buy some tables and some chairs and some plates and throw a grill up there and now you have a restaurant. And, you know, I see it as, wow, this is extreme commerce happening. You can't knock that part, but there's also not a whole lot of vigilance as far as the government's concerned. So these new places, they're, you know, a lot of places, oh, no, we can't give you an official invoice. Oh, we don't take credit cards. Hey, you know, it's like, let's see, does that sound legal?
Even in Mexico.
We don't need no stinking liquor license.
Uh-huh. Exactly. So, you know, and those things are going to start to change. There's going to start to be corrections. The growth has become to a point where we're no longer this little dust spot where it's big tourism dollars and pesos in business, and the government's going to want their piece.
Yeah. Drew, last year, weren't there a couple of not raids, but citations slapped on restaurants that were serving liquor illegally.
Oh no, totally. Yeah. And it's going to be even more extreme this year.
How did they not just Mordida their way out of those?
That, you know, the Mordida thing is sort of a myth. I don't even like to refer to that because we're not participating in that. And I think it gets a lot.
There's some who do though. There's some who do, and I've spoken to them.
But I think it's one of the bad raps that and it's now my country because now I'm Mexican. Became Mexican this year. I think it's a bad stereotype of what's going on. I don't think everyone's corrupt is what
And it's a system. By not participating in it, you know, you help to quell it and kind of hopefully over time kill it.
Well, at least you get to look yourself in the mirror at night.
Yeah, true.
Well, I'm also going to ask the question is, it may be illegal on the books, but is it immoral or fattening? I mean, is it really different places have different ethical structures, and I'm not sure that mordida is necessarily unethical, even if it is illegal.
It streamlines things. Typically,
let's tell the listeners what mordida is.
Mordida is bribe. It's the Spanish word for bribe.
It means the little bite.
The old saying in certain parts of Mexico is that there are three ways to get a liquor license. You can go and you can do it the way that we do it up here. You can go to the beer companies and essentially sell pouring rights to your place, and they give you a liquor license. Or you can do absolutely nothing and wait till the inspector comes and get your liquor license temporarily on the spot in the form of a bribe. I'm definitely not saying that everyone does the latter, because that's clearly not true. But there are certainly some places that do that and that still do that. And my question is, if you take the law out of it and look at it as something that is a matter of ethics, is it really unethical to supplement the salary of someone who's taken a very low salary in part expecting to be able to make to make ends meet through that part of the system? Is that truly unethical?
How long is this podcast?
Well, I mean, but part of what we're talking about here too, though, is what the Valle is doing for Baja is breaking that stereotype, right? The Valle has become its own economy,
and
so
intending or trying to be an example for sustainability and shortening the distance between producer and consumption, and by being good stewards of the growth. We can't stop the growth, but we can be a steward, sort of guiding the growth in the right direction. We don't want Walmarts and – excuse me right. for the brand name. We don't want big box stores and more convenience stores.
Right.
And so how do we as and I'm new. I'm not as new as some people, but I mean I've only been there 6 years. There's people that have been there a lot longer than I have. And I'm still learning every day, and I really like where I live. And I want to see it succeed, but I also want to see it sort of maintain its essence and its soul.
Well, how is that going to happen without addressing the water issues?
You know, I think the water issues they're real. We had one of the smallest rainfalls on record this year. I think we only got like 4 inches, which –
How do you grow wine?
It's tough. You can only do it for so long. It's obviously not sustainable because now we're pulling from the aquifer. We're bringing water in from other places. There's rumors of a privatized desal plant that will then sell the water to the valley. I know there's a project for using recycled treatment plant water from Tijuana to use for ag water, which I think is a phenomenal solution because, I mean, guys, you're not drinking it, and it's
right.
It's I mean, and as long as it's coming in clean, what a great way to reuse water.
And by the way, to the extent that it isn't, the earth itself is going to filter that water.
They're talking about actually doing a pipeline from Tijuana.
Well, they would have to
the Valle.
There's no way they could do it otherwise without that.
Right.
But this is all being driven though by the
growth.
Not by the growth, right? Because the water issues were always present, just
right,
like they are in San Diego.
But the consumption
you didn't have a million people coming into the Valle every year.
But before the Valle started growing, remember the Valle de Guadalupe is administratively part of the municipality of Ensenada. And before the growth that we're talking about in the Valle de Guadalupe, Ensenada was already two-thirds down on its raw water requirements. So ground, the starting line for this
you're
handicapped. You're starting tomorrow. They started yesterday.
Sounds like May for the Padres.
Yeah, pretty much. It's being fueled by the growth. The exigency is fueled by the growth. The problem the problem is acute, and it was acute on day one.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you have a unique situation there as opposed to like Napa or Sonoma, for instance, where Napa and Sonoma were, and currently are somewhat limited by the geography, right? There's only so many places that you can grow grapes, where the Valle de Guadalupe, you've got a lot of space that can still be fleshed out there. So at some point, there's going to have to be a moratorium or some type of municipal control on the growth. Well, it's not sustainable.
And how's that going to happen in Mexico?
Well, and so back to the original point, with what the Valle, with the notice and the recognition that the Valle is getting, Mexico is going to have to get a little bit more proactive, not only in all of the points that we talked about, paying their inspectors more, giving them a living wage so that they don't have to depend on Mordita, and also starting to regulate what's going on.
Well, and there's also groups like Provino who are protectionist groups. And it's Provino is the official winery sort of
association
of the wineries. It's
trade group.
It's very specific in what wineries it lets in. You have to meet certain requirements. You have to have the right intentions. Provino is a group that is one of the stewards, one of the shepherds that are helping with the growth. And when something seems out of line, Provino is an activist group as well that's able to really gather the troops and go to the zoning commission steps and stop things that are happening. And up to this point, being grassroots has been effective in changing the direction of some of those Mordida decisions.
And it's a tough road to go down too, because as an association like that, at some point then you start being considered exclusionary, right?
And those are some of the criticisms that Provino receives already.
But the same could be said about the government. One of the issues in Mexico for a long time has been the perception, whether it's reality or not, really doesn't matter because the perception is the reality, that certain people have access to government and can influence the way the government acts in their direction in a way that most people do not. And so how's that really any different?
No, it's basically you choosing your sort of ethical context and saying, okay, I want this for the valley, and this other group is just saying they want this for the valley, and it's just, may the best man win kind of thing.
One of the solutions that was that was proposed for some of the water, for a portion of the water problems, was that essentially a couple of the big wineries would team together and help fund a major water project. They would then distribute the water to others in the valley. And that was basically shut down when everyone else got together and said, you're not going to be choking my water line. And they were willing to sit there and wait until something else came along. Wasn't that the same thing too?
Yep, very similar. Yeah, for sure.
What percentage, since we have – since I may be the only actual real Mexican in the room – I had that DNA test done last year. 3% Central American, right?
Oh,
here.
There you
impressive.
Go.
Impressive.
And I don't know how that got in there, but
what
percentage?
Please don't.
Now I can't unsee that. How many? What would you say the percentage of Americans crossing the border? On a regular basis, or I'm sorry, not a regular basis. What am I trying to say? How many Americans are visiting Valle de Guadalupe? Percentage wise, is it half? Is it 70%?
In our restaurant, we're about half Mexican nationals and half non-Mexican tourists.
In my travels and adventures around the Valle, I see about the same.
About 50-50.
About 50-50.
Okay. My perception, and maybe it's just maybe we all see what we're expecting to see. I would have put it more 2/3, 1/3 Mexican.
With Mexican in the
yes.
majority?
Yeah, I can only speak for Deckman's, so right. I don't know what's happening in other places.
Drew and Javier both get a lot of really good press and publicity.
Absolutely.
North of the border, and have been for a while. So that those are
and they thank if you for that, Scott.
Oh, no worries, guys. So if you're an American going down to Valle for the first time, chances are you're going to eat at Deckman's or you're going to eat at a Finca Altozano. And then hopefully you go down more times and discover that there's also a lot of other great restaurants to try in the region as well.
As an American crossing the border, is it necessary to be well-to-do, you know, in the upper? I mean, is it what would you say?
I don't. There's something for everyone. You know, there's a stand where the three and the one meet, where they sell quail and conejo grilled rabbit. You can have a meal for $5 or $6.
Las Hueritas.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'll need to get the address.
But also, as an American going down with the peso exchange rate, everything's half priced basically when you go to Mexico. So the power of the dollar in Mexico right now is way higher than it has been in the past. So, I mean, that opens up to, you know, way more sort of broadens the economic, I don't know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, no, well, no. Well, you know what I'm trying to say. My point is, because we have listeners here, probably some of which have not visited the Valle, I would assume quite a few, trying to figure it out. So what are some recommendations you can give to people in terms of planning a trip, a weekend, a day or so in the Valle? Because it really is, it's an hour and a half, nice coastal drive down there.
I drove up this morning.
Hour and a half drive home. You could certainly spend a Saturday or Sunday down there and come home and have plenty of time for a nap in the evening. Yeah. What's some recommendations you would give?
My first recommendation, because a lot of people text me and go, hey, Scott, I'm going to the Valle for the first time. I want to hit 8 wineries and 5 restaurants in a day. And it's like, you know what? Slow it down. This is Mexico. You're not going to Mexico to bum rush all these wineries and do as much as you can do.
I don't think you can do that in Napa either.
Yeah. No.
8 in a day, you're done, dude.
You're on the ground after the forest one. Yes. but my first recommendation is slow down. Enjoy Mexico. Enjoy the people. Enjoy the food. Enjoy the ambiance. Enjoy the scenery. So my when we do a tour, we go down ourselves on a day trip, you know, we usually have to hit a few, maybe 2 or 3 wineries, kind of linger, and then we may have breakfast with Doña Stella, and then we'll have a late lunch / early dinner somewhere. And that's a perfect day. You know, you can linger, you can take it all in, you know, and then you can just repeat that over.
And what you want to do when you go down there to the wineries is you want to focus on one part of the Valle. The Valle is actually a surprisingly big place, and the wines are very different at the northeast corner from the southwest corner. And figure out where you want to go, which part, and then focus on a couple places there.
Or do a line. You know, start at the – you come up through La Mission, start at the –
excuse me?
Southern end and – no, wait a minute. Not that kind of line. A line with your car. White lines. But, you know, you start – you know, go to Alximia. It's one of the first places you hit.
Just the white lines. Not the other kind.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. The Valle is not the place to do a line. You want to relax, but you can plan your day so that you're going to start in the southern end of the Valle and end up at the northern end. We cross out through Tecate most of the time because we live in East County, San Diego. It's a much shorter wait at the border typically, and frankly, the Border Patrol guards are a lot nicer than at San Ysidro.
I crossed at Tecate this morning.
Yeah.
I just like the drive to the rocks.
The drive from the Valle to Tecate is beautiful. The drive from the border to San Diego
is awesome.
Absolutely awesome. Yeah.
Stunning either way.
Yeah.
Stunning either way.
All right. Well, we're nearing the end of our broadcast. I want to do the specialty produce product of the week. It's a fruit this time. Drew, what is it?
This is Meyer lemon, which is a cross between a regular lemon and a Satsuma orange, right?
Yes.
And, you know, I'm big into oysters, so I like
Meyer. I've noticed.
Yeah. Meyer lemon, mignonette. Used the Meyer lemon juice, a little sweeter than a regular lemon. The cool thing about the Meyer lemon is you can eat all of it.
Absolutely every bit.
The other thing that we do a lot with the Meyers, when we get them, where we also get some fresh bergamot in the Valle as well, is we'll slice them and we'll do we'll cure them in salt and leave them for a year and a half, which is a really Mediterranean way to deal with citrus. I've tried them whole. I don't have the patience because I want to use it.
Yeah.
So we slice them and
so it's basically like a Moroccan
exactly same thing. Northern preserve. African. Yeah. Totally.
Yeah, and it's a I'm going to basically take them. I'm going to pickle the rind and use the juice in a tapenade.
Oh, nice. Yeah, that'll be tasty.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, slice it up, add it to a little tiradito, a little ceviche. Works very nicely with fish. You can put a little sugar on that sucker and put it on the rim of your martini, of your
it's actually,
lemon martini, if you want.
It's actually very sweet in and of itself. I mean, mm-hmm. It's often just called the sweet lemon.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's test that. Take a bite, Michael.
You wouldn't be able to tell the difference in the looks on his face.
Yeah. Sour look on my face anyway. Or a sweet look. So, Sheen?
Real thin slices, throw it on a hot grill, caramelize it as much as you can.
With all the
moisture in there, and it goes with what can you not eat that with that point, right?
Yeah.
I mean.
Great with grilled fish and, I mean, just.
Yeah. And so if you want to know more about either these Meyer lemons or about the fava beans that we use, you can go to the Specialty Produce website, and you're going to find all of the information that you want about the products right there. And
fantastic.
That's paying a couple of bills.
There you go.
All right, guys. Well, thank you very much. It's been a wonderful show. This is not going to be the last show that we do on the Via de Guadalupe.
But boy, it was a great first one.
It was a very good. It was
thanks,
a very
guys,
good first one.
For inviting
and
us.
And we will we'll see you back in a couple weeks for our next broadcast. And we're going to be bringing in Anthony Sensei and Jason Nibb talking about going home again chef style.
And we're out. See ya.
We're out. Right.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
The Specialty Produce app is the world's number one handheld resource on produce. The app features photographs, recipes, geography and history, taste and culinary applications on over 1,900 produce items. From apples to zapote, we've got your produce questions answered. Our app is available for both iPhone and Android. Download our app for free today.